This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Hello, Catherine.
Hi. Feels very deja vu-y today. Deja vu is never a good word between us, I don't reckon.
No, it's true. But you are, tell us what's happened, because you are stuck in
now
your house again.
COVID me. I actually have not yet tested positive for COVID, but my kids have.
Oh, are they okay?
They are living their best lives. They are so, I mean, they have mild sniffles, but mostly they are eating butter menthols by the bucket load and watching TV.
Wow. And did they test positive on the same day? Have you got a short time frame here?
No, they didn't. Oscar was first and he was a complete surprise. I think all of us were like, what?
Really? It was just like your random Monday morning test.
Your Monday morning test. And then Tilly was devastated because she then had to go to school. But now Thursday, she's tested positive as well. So they're out there fighting over who gets to pick what episodes and doing Lego. So
at least they're
hopefully they're good. Like, it continues like that.
And it has led to just as I had to withdraw from Newcastle because of family COVID, you also have a devastating withdrawal.
Bendigo Writers Festival was so excited. Two glorious nights in the Quality Lakeside Hotel.
Damn that! Two nights.
Quality misleading.
Well, I must admit when I saw that, I was like, I'm just going to look that up, because when you say quality, I don't know what that means, but we're sure it's going to be amazing. I mean, no stress about
not to rub it in.
No.
Yeah, I was very excited. So disappointed about that, but probably that's inevitable, isn't it? Everyone is going to miss out on some stuff. I was really looking forward to interviewing, both of us were interviewing Vanessa Len.
Yes.
Who has written a cracker of a YA novel called Only a Monster. We were just talking off air about how much we both liked it.
Yeah, absolute cracker. I finished it on Mother's Day morning. Well, you know, when you get that little extra bit of time, or some people get that extra little bit of time when there's general chaos going on to bring you a cup of coffee in bed. I finished it then, and yeah, really
it's
good.
It's so good. It's so good. Great world building. I was very interested to hear how she built that world, because that's the art of, I mean, fantasy, obviously it's plot as well, but so fiddly having to come up with rules within a world and then tell them in such a way that is not front loaded with.
Absolutely.
And if people do this, then this happens.
Mm-hmm. You know? It will be very exciting. And in fact, our listeners who can't make it to Bendigo will be able to hear that conversation, because that is a live record for the podcast. So they will be able to hear that. So tell us, what else have you been reading? Are you getting extra reading done in lockdown?
Not especially. Just on Vanessa, I just wanted to say as well, I read her acknowledgements, and she talks about going to the Clarion Workshop in San Diego, which then I started Googling.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's an incredible, incredible workshop, and that led me to one of my favourite workshop Googles, which is the Iowa Writers
Workshop,
where I just torture myself by looking at how that would work. I know that you did Sarah and Tilly's. I'm feeling so much workshop retreat.
Yeah.
Envy, for which there is no cure, because it just is not feasible at this moment in life.
No, exactly. And I think, like, maybe there can be a bunch of us when our kids hit, you know,
yeah,
move out 20, stage or 20 16. And that we can just go and be like the cool mature age students at Iowa. You know, the interesting thing about Clarion, and I'm going to ask Vanessa about this in the session, is that I interviewed coming up on our master's series is the incredible Margot Lanigan, sci-fi writer extraordinaire. And she has been both a student and mentor at Clarion. And I think she was there when Vanessa was there. So very interesting to hear. World. And she's, in that interview, the master's series interview with Margot, she does share some amazing advice about world building as well. So that's a fun one that is coming up.
Amazing. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by HarperCollins Australia, and we are delighted to be talking to Felicity McLean about her new book, Red. Felicity McLean's debut novel, The Van Apfel Girls Are Gone, has been published in more than half a dozen countries. It was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick in the US and was shortlisted for the Indie Book Awards and longlisted for the UK's Dagger Awards and the Davit. Her book, Body Lengths, co-written with Olympian Liesl Jones, was Apple Books' best biography of 2015 and won the 2016 Australian Book Industry Awards Reader's Choice for a Small Publisher Adult Book of the Year. Whew, that is a great bio. Welcome, Felicity.
Thank you so much for having me along today.
Felicity, your latest novel is Red. Can you give us the pitch?
Sure. Look, Red is a loose, very loose, contemporary retelling of the Ned Kelly story, where Ned Kelly is now a teenage girl with flaming red hair and a temper to match. And the story is set in the early 1990s, in the years leading up to the Royal Commission into alleged police corruption, because the Ned Kelly story is nothing if not riddled with police corruption. Mm. And like a good Sydney cider, I've also gone and pinched it from Victoria. So the story is now set on the central coast of New South Wales. And Red kind of ricochets around between all these wonderful towns. They're real towns like Wyoming and Saratoga, which is straight from the Wild West, because the Ned Kelly story is nothing if not a Western as well. Mm.
Brendan Cowell is quoted on the cover, and he says that the book is Winton meets Tarantino in Woy Woy, which is such a wonderful description. I've been to Woy Woy, so I know that place well.
Yeah, that was so generous of Brendan. I said to him I'd like that on my tombstone one day. I think that's such a great quote.
Felicity, it's a pretty unusual kind of premise, really, this Ned Kelly retelling. Where did the idea for the book come from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wanted to reimagine the Ned Kelly story because I feel like there's something just endlessly fascinating about the Ned Kelly story. Apparently there are more books and more songs written about Ned Kelly and the Kelly Gang than any other historical figure in Australia. And in northwestern Australia, the Yarralan people, the Indigenous people there, have even incorporated Ned Kelly into one of their Dreamtime legends. So Ned Kelly now goes off to England with Captain Cook. So they've taken the story and done something with it as well, which I think is so interesting. But my Ned Kelly, I thought, should be a teenage girl in the 1990s to make Australia's Rebel a little less male, a little less stale. But really what I wanted to see was how would we feel about Ned Kelly, you know, our larrikin Ned Kelly, if he was a she? Would we sympathise as much? Would we identify as much? And would we judge her more harshly than we would that larrikin male Ned Kelly?
It's so interesting. As someone who worked at the State Library and took students to see the Ned Kelly armour, I can absolutely vouch for the endless obsession with the Kelly story. I'm so looking forward to reading this, Felicity. You're combining two things here, both that Ned Kelly story and the Ruby story. What did you really want to bring out? What did you want to capture about each of those stories?
I guess one thing I wanted to look at was I wanted to make it a story about stories. So we do have that Western element because it's fundamentally, it's a goodies and baddies, you know, the oppressed versus the cops. So I wanted that sort of neo-Western. Mm. There's also some Greek myths in there. So Ruby, she in this is true to the Ned Kelly story, she rescues her friend from the river, and Ned Kelly did the same thing, and he received a green sash. But in my book, Ruby receives a green leather-bound book, and it's a book of Greek myths. So she becomes really interested in these sort of feisty, fearsome female warriors. And so it's got these Greek myths threaded through it as well. But fundamentally, it's also about the kind of the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. What does it mean for Australia culturally if we hold up this criminal, essentially, as, you know, this is such a big part of who, in modern day Australia, who we think we are. He was this male criminal from so long ago. So these stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and Ruby uncovers all these stories about her own personal family history. She sort of has, you know, things revealed to her, family secrets that she didn't realise. So it's about the stories we tell ourselves.
You've obviously done so much research for this book in different areas, and you mentioned just before the period in the early 90s leading up to the Royal Commission. Was that specifically why you chose the time period, and what did the research involve to get that period right?
Yeah, I learned a lot about cars and about guns. I really knew nothing about, but there's a lot of cars and a lot of guns in the story, so I learned a lot there. Yeah, in setting it in the early 90s, I didn't have that time period in mind. I came around to it because it just seemed so perfect. This was, you know, we hadn't had the Ward Royal Commission into alleged police corruption yet in New South Wales. So police corruption was rife, I mean, on the Central Coast as well as in Sydney, which I learned as well. So it was too good a time period not to use, I felt.
Well, see, let's talk about the writing process. Where did you begin?
The process was really different this time around. So this was my second novel and it already had a home. So I'd signed a 2-book deal with HarperCollins. So it had a home already when I started out, which is always a nice thing. And this was a book written in two halves. So I wanted something that was a real change of pace. My first novel was The Van Apfel Girls Are Gone. And that was kind of a really dreamy, ethereal kind of Picnic at Hanging Rock vibe, and I'd spent 3 years writing it and then promoting it here and in the States. So I wanted something fast-paced and a bit wild and rollicking. So that's what I, you know, just for my own interest, that's what I was after. So I sat down and started writing, and it was pretty fast and furious and quite cathartic. I wanted it to be like all run-on sentences and no punctuation, just like Ned Kelly's Gerildery Letters. And I got about 40,000 words in. You can like pick up the book, crack the spine. I was on that middle page when the pandemic hit. And suddenly everything changed. We were homeschooling our children and, you know, everything was different. We were in lockdown. We moved house as well. I just put it in a drawer. I know, right? So I put the manuscript in a drawer and I didn't touch it for 12 months. I just didn't have the time or the bandwidth to even think about it. And I kept, in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, God, am I going to be able to pick this up again? Will I remember who the characters are? Will I remember where I was going with this? And I felt like the whole world had changed so much. Did we really want a fast and furious, angry book? Did it suit the mood anymore? So after 12 months, I pulled it out again and got started. And then, of course, you know, we've had things like when Grace Tame got up and spoke at the press club recently, and people were so outraged at a girl expressing anger, a female expressing anger. And I thought, no, we still need to talk about this. this hasn't gone away. Yeah, so that was, in some ways, that was a relief that I felt like it was still a book that was relevant.
As you were speaking, both Kate and I were just nodding. Very, very big nods.
Big nods.
Felicity, you mentioned this is your third book. You had a previous novel. You also co-wrote a biography with the Olympic swimmer Liesl Jones. Pretty varied work. What's been the best part about your book publishing adventure so far?
That's a good question. I love meeting readers. I love chatting to readers and getting their hot take on what they think about what you've written. I find library visits are great for that. especially with the Van Apfel girls, it's no secret that that's got a really open ending. It's left very much up in the air. And readers would just come up and quiz me about it or tell me what they thought. And I love that. I love hearing what people think. It's like when you go to the movies with someone and then you come out afterwards and you've got to, you know, what did you think? What about that? You know, got to break it down. So that's always fun.
You mentioned that the book came out in the US as well. Did you get over to the US? Did you get to meet US readers?
I did. So it came out in a bunch of places, but I got to go to the US, which was fantastic. My publisher over there, Algonquin, is this cool indie publisher in New York. So I got to do some events in New York, at Bryant Park in New York, and in San Fran and LA as dream. Well, which was really cool. It was really fun.
God, that feels a world away.
Yeah, it does. I know, especially after COVID, like we haven't been on a plane since. So it really feels like a different universe.
So that was the best bit. What's been the most challenging?
The most challenging, I think, changes with every book. I feel like every book is a completely different animal. So I've actually ghostwritten a bunch of books. And every single time I do that, it feels like there's a different challenge. With Van Apfel, I ran into all sorts of plotting disasters. So I had post-it notes everywhere. This time round, I really nailed down the plot. That was my learning from last time. This time I really nailed down the plot, but then, of course, I had that really interrupted process. So I feel like the challenges are ever-changing.
We always like to get advice from writers for writers on this show, Felicity. What is either the best or even the worst writing advice you've ever received?
The best writing advice is just read. I feel like I had so many teachers at school that were like, wide reading is so important, and now I get it. I feel like reading anything, read the back of a cereal box, reading, you are learning all the time how to write. And if you're not, it's impossible not to pick up something, but even if you don't, you have a really good time reading. So, you know, it's not wasted time, but yeah, reading is my hot tip for writing.
Felicity, on reading, can you please recommend for us a debut book, any time, any genre?
Do you know, I read Diana Reid's Love and Virtue and it was fabulous. I had such a good time reading it. I felt like she may have spent some time at Sydney Uni where I went to uni. It felt so familiar. But then also I think that is part of the brilliance of that book is I don't think it would matter what experience you'd had at university, it would feel familiar. So, yeah, I really enjoy that.
Excellent recommendation.
Felicity, do you have any events coming up? I know that Red comes out, I think, the day that this podcast is being released. Where can our listeners find you?
I'll be speaking at the Words on the Waves Festival at the Central Coast at the beginning of June.
It's a very fitting location.
That's right, yeah, on the Central Coast, where it all happened. We're doing a great panel about women and history with Hannah Kent and Kate Forsyth. So,
amazing.
I know, right? Yeah, that would be fun.
Fantastic. Felicity McLean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The other great book that I have been reading is a cozy crime novel. I like cozy crime. I've only recently...
What is the definition of cozy crime?
Learned the term cozy crime. I'm not really sure. I think it's just like kind of funny crime that doesn't feel threatening in any way.
Is it like those ABC, like that kind of little English town kind of crime?
Can be. The one I think of is Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman.
It's
sort of for older people, but I think it marries funny and crime. And it never feels, it's not really anything that would ever keep you up late at night worrying that it's very non-threatening.
Yeah, excellent.
But this one is Death at the Belvedere by Sue Williams. It is her fourth in this series. It's set around a small town in Victoria called Rusty Boar. The main character, Cass, runs a fish and chip shop and is an unlicensed investigator. They're just nice, really easy, fun reads. The first couple, the titles all had fish and chip shop puns, like Murder with the Lot. Well, they seem to have moved away from that. But it's that nice experience of they're all standalone. But if you like this one, then there are others that you can also delve into. So big recommend. Death at the Belvedere by Sue Williams.
Death at the Belvedere, that's very cool. I do like a fish and chip shop pun, I must say. I had my little retreat with Sarah Centilles, which was amazing. And I did spend 3 days of that on my own, which was also amazing.
I think that's the way to do it. I cannot come at this idea of a retreat in my own house.
Well, this was a 1 week one. So I did half of it on my own at my gorgeous friend's house solo, and then half of it back home. And it is just that the world intrudes. So I think the most incredible thing that Sarah asked you to do is to be off socials and off the news. And that is so useful. And the other incredible thing was that Tessa's house where I stayed, it's a new kind of holiday house. They've only just moved into it. So there was there's some furniture, but there wasn't much else to distract me. So because of the rules on social media and news and the rest of it, and I had out of office on my email, I really felt that the urge every time I was like, nah, I'm resisting. I've got to stand up and go and do something. There was nothing else to do. So I had to just keep writing. It was really powerful and really useful, but I did do some reading there. And one of the things I listened to on the way down, so I listened to it first as an audiobook, was The Practice by Seth Godin. And I reckon you've told me about Seth Godin before, maybe, and I've never actually taken that in through my ears. You know, sometimes I do that.
He's really interesting.
He's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I came
His blog is amazing.
Akimbo. Like
the original blogger.
Yes. So we'll put a link into the blog. And I came to it originally because I've been listening to Emma Gannon's Control Alt Delete, that podcast, which I find really useful. She's a writer, but talking a lot about work practices and creativity and other things as well. Anyway, so she interviewed Seth Godin on his latest book called The Practice. And then I listened to that. Now I will make a recommendation because I have, since listening to it, I've purchased it. It's kind of in that Jerry Saltz vibe of like small numbered paragraphs of things. So it's a little bit hard to listen to on audiobook. Like it served its purpose, but I really did want to see it and be able to kind of mark it up as I did it. But I really liked it. It focuses on that kind of get rid of the genius myth idea and you don't need to be in the mood and all the rest of it, and just about sitting down and doing the work. Lots of other things besides, but I really recommend that one. It was good. Or check out his work on his blog or on Akimbo first to see if it kind of vibes with you. So that was a really useful thing to have in my ears as I was doing the retreat. So I went between that and a book that I've already mentioned, which is Lee Kaufman's The Rider Laid Bare, which was fantastic and which I could recommend wholeheartedly to all of the other people in the Sarah Centilles Word Cave as well, because it was another really useful one to dip into as you're doing the work. You know how sometimes you just need that like pat on your shoulder pep talk? So that was very good. Highly recommend all of those things. What have you been listening to?
Seth Godin's.
Yeah.
Did you listen on Audible?
Yeah, I think I did.
So do you have an Audible subscription?
I do.
Yeah, I'm a bit – I also have an Audible subscription, which is new, but it's like one book a month is how it works.
Yeah. Yes, I often, well, coming up to summer, I always have to buy more, but then during the year, I'm often like prompted to get them. The kids listen a lot. Yeah. I'm deeply torn because at the moment too, I'm looking at and I'm writing about Amazon. And so like all things, it's just, I can remember when you were talking about, I think you were talking about banks and super a while ago when we were talking about climate action, and it's just the extricating yourself from anything is so hard. I mean, that's why they do it, right? To get you in. So I really want an alternative to Audible, actually. And I think that there's some, there are meant to be some good ones, but it's just so hard.
No, I feel like a lot of the others seem to go targeted more towards libraries. I mean, libraries is, there's no digital lending rights currently.
Yeah.
So there's no feedback loop necessarily to writers as far as I know. Mm. But yeah, I feel that same internal conflict about Audible.
Mm. I know.
Mm.
More investigation needed here. Maybe that's something that we can do to share with our dear listeners. What have you been listening to? I always love your podcast and Audible recommendations because they're always so damn different to mine.
Well, this one I can guarantee you won't listen to. It is, I got a new phone. I dropped my phone, so I got a new phone. And my podcast app, like I lost all my podcast links, some of which are time limited anyway. Once you've listened to the season, it's over. Yeah. But that is my justification for listening to Two Teas in a Pod, not to be confused with Two Peas in a Pod, which is an Australian podcast that features two mums that have children with complex disabilities. Two Teas in a Pod is two former Real Housewives, Teddy Mellencamp and Tamra Judge, and they break down episodes of Housewives and interview Real Housewives. And it is a brat where my brain is at the moment, and great.
Can you do, I feel like you need to do some kind of think piece on Real Housewives because, like, it is really your vibe.
I think it's my current vibe. It's actually pretty well analysed. You would be surprised. Oh, okay.
That's right. We've talked about this. Yeah. Like if I need to go in, I can already.
Surprisingly covered off. Okay. The other one I've only listened to a couple of episodes of, but a few people had recommended it. It's called Diary of a CEO. And the host is Stephen Bartlett. He basically interviews people who are at the top of their game, probably more entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting. And one of the interviews that I listened to was with a guy called Ben Francis, who set up a company. He's from the UK called Gymshark, which is a multi-billion, gazillion-dollar company. He set it up when he was 19. And so he talks about that experience and some of the challenges of that. He originally set it up with someone else. But he also did pretty early on, so he was pretty cocky and sort of acknowledges that, did a 360-degree feedback performance review. Have you heard of those?
Yeah, I've done them.
Oh, have you done it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he said, so basically you get people, you would get someone who maybe that you report to, people that report to you, kind of peers, colleagues. I think it's generally in a work environment, that give you anonymous feedback. It goes to a company first, so it's filtered a little bit and collated and all that sort of stuff. And he said he got really scathing feedback.
Whoa.
And he talks through what he did and how he coped with it. Initially he ignored it, and then he'd happened to leave it on the table and his girlfriend read it and he was like, oh, that's a piece of, you know, that's just crap. And she was like, this is like the most profoundly you thing I've ever read in my life. So then he was like, I kind of have to deal with it. But he talks about how he then made a list of all his strengths and weaknesses and sort of started to go through the list. But it just is a really interesting story of a guy who, and the host even says, I met you when you were about 20 or 21. You were really shy. You were presenting on something. You seemed very nervous. You've really come a long way since then. And he sort of talks through how he went from one thing to the other, but it's just got a nice message around the things that you're bad at are not fixed, you know?
Yes. That's good. That's good. Yeah, this is the one thing. You haven't had to do it in your workplace? That kind of.
No, I think by virtue of probably where I work now, they do it for more senior people.
Yeah.
And I think also if you are part-time, you can sort of sidle out of a lot of,
I must admit that that's one of the great joys of working for oneself and no longer being in an organisation, that one doesn't have to submit oneself to all those kinds of activities, although maybe it's really helpful. Maybe we should do it with our publisher, agent, editor, colleagues.
Oh, pretty tough.
Readers. That's what Goodreads is, right? We shouldn't have to deal with it.
good reads, it's brutal. But one thing that I saw someone tweeting about this podcast, Diary of a CEO, was that they were saying that kids these days want to start a business. They don't want to start a band, and that entrepreneurialism is the new rock and roll, which is an interesting thing to think. Probably don't want a world in which we favour business over the arts and music, but I can certainly see a thread of that in life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, I'm going to put that one on my list. Maybe not the Real Housewives one, but definitely that one.
Have you got some good listens?
On things I've been listening to, I listened to your amazing interview with Andy Griffiths and it was so good.
Yeah, he's good. He's a really, I remember seeing him interviewed at the Victorian Writers' Centre once. So going into that interview, I was like, you're going to have good stories.
And I think that the story of how he got there and that knowing that he was doing the right thing, like I think you said that like he'd tested the material. So it was ridiculous that the publishers didn't go for it, but he had tested the material.
Yeah. Well, people might have listened, they might not have, but he came from a teaching background and was trying to engage kids who were not at all interested in books. I found him really interesting just even, and we spoke after the recording about his interest in comedy. Did you ever know The Young Ones or some of those like punk comedy stuff? Like hearing that gave me so much context for him as a writer.
And all that rock and roll, like the rock and roll stuff, the humor, you can just see the it was really clear to see the genesis of him as a writer to what he is now, and also that connection between like the kind of just throwing together of him and Terry and then going with it. That's like that kind of improvisation thing.
If he was saying in the interview or if he said it after, but they also have really different work styles. Like Terry is leave it to the end and Andy is, which I wish I'd asked more about because that's such that's the opposite of each other. He's like everything needs to be planned. And Terry's like.
I loved it. So if people haven't listened to it yet, get on it. Catherine talking to Andy and making all of our children finally realise that, you know, we are total rock star material. If you get Andy Griffiths on the podcast, then that's it. You are actually famous.
Yeah, my kids were super impressed.
No, I haven't got any other good listens except for I've been doing a lot of deep diving as I do on the authors that I love and that I'm trying desperately to secure interviews with. And one of them is Jennifer Egan, who I mentioned I'd read The Candy House and loved it. And so, again, while I was on retreat, I watched one of her only events that's up online yet, which is with the Philadelphia Free Library, and I'll put in a link to it. Really good, interesting discussion. And at the end of it, she mentioned that she has a brand new website. So I went onto it because it sounded really interesting and oh my goodness. So we'll put in a link. It's just jennifer.egan.com. And for those people who have read A Visit to the Goon Squad and The Candy House, they're, you know, very experimental in form. They're interlinked stories connected through loose threads over time and through characters. So the website not only shows, so you kind of
just
hover.
Looking on. Now.
Yeah, yeah, it's so cool. So you hover over different sections, which takes you through into like a section of published work from The Candy House. And if you hover over that, it takes you back. You can click through to the draft of the same section.
Oh,
and if you
God.
Hover over that, you can click through to the original notes. And sometimes there's even like an Easter egg in there where you hover again and it takes you back to the original inspiration for the story. So incredible in looking at, especially for writers and particularly people like me who are obsessed with process, but also to see how, you know, a celebrated writer like that, the process from notes to published work is always so messy and chaotic. But the other incredible thing that the website does is then it links words in the text through to the connections in other parts of The Candy House or back to the Goon Squad or in other parts of Egan's writing. So it's just this very
God, I'm looking at it right now. It's
so cool. Very meta, very cool addition to, like, a companion, I suppose, to her work. I'm so interested in that and very much hoping that we'll get to talk to her about it. But that was, yeah, just a there fun...
So much work in this.
So much work. So she talked about she had a specific designer on to do it. But I think that impulse to share share the process behind the work and what goes into it is a really interesting one and very helpful for people who are studying that kind of work. So that was very cool. That's something that I urge everyone to look at. And I have to tell you what I've been watching because I, in fact, had these notes down. This was also on retreat. So I think I may have mentioned this before that I like to get a series, especially for when I'm going away on my own and writing, that I get a little series that's the one that I then go to at night and generally something that propels me in the writing. So when I was doing the work on the 1930s, I was watching and the kind of abattoir stuff that I was writing, I was watching Peaky Blinders, and that's what my kind of, it's like a tonal thing. You don't even have to be watching it entirely, but it's like listening to a soundtrack. Anyway, my sister had recommended to me Be Foreigners. I don't even know how to pronounce it properly. Be Foreigners on SBS. Oh my Lord, it is so good. So basic premise, it's Norwegian. It's a cop buddy crime kind of genre. That's the general genre that it's in. But it begins with the premise that flashes of light start appearing in the water in Oslo and all around the world. And then people appear in the water. And when these people are brought up and looked after on by emergency services, it's established very quickly that they are time refugees, time migrants. So they've come from four particular periods in time, Neanderthal, Viking kind of era, and the 1900s kind of Victorian era. And they all start appearing. And then it jumps very quickly. It jumps into kind of life when this has been established for about 10 years and there's a kind of a system for how these migrants are dealt with all around the world. It is so clever, so scathing in its kind of allegorical look at refugees and the refugee situation all around the world. So funny. Just really laugh out loud funny. And the way that it mashes up the cop buddy genre with this kind of sci-fi, but then very, very clear kind of realism as well. So that for people who go, oh, I would never watch something like that. Like, that sounds wacky. It's very much just like watching any kind of Nordic crime. That's the vibe in it. And I watched all the way through. There's maybe 8 episodes in the first season. I could not stop watching at night. I did not probably get as much sleep as I could. But the last episode of the second season is like one of those ones where I was jumping out of my seat or like talking to the screen where I was like, oh my gosh, no way, you didn't just do that. It was the payoffs that had been planted like so early in the first season coming to fruition in that episode.
So good.
So satisfying. Like, just, you know, when it's deeply satisfying storytelling. So I've been talking about it to everyone that I know. I highly recommend that.
What
people,
is it called again?
Say it's the called name again. Be Foreigners. So the word before in front of foreigners.
Foreigners.
It's on SBS. That. It's just very clever. And I think the it's a couple who wrote it. They've done some other stuff before, but this is it's HBO, beautifully produced, like just really flash. The stars are terrific, but just, yeah, all over great. In fact, I talked about it so much. Mum and Dad were watching it at a similar time, and I got a message from them one morning, like that they'd stayed up to finish watching it till 2 a.m., which is very unlike my parents because they were just so into it. So that's my recommendation.
I'm excited.
Yeah. What about you? What have you been watching?
Not a heap, really. Lego Masters, probably.
Lego Masters. Yeah.
I did want to mention, not on the watching bent, but just a small article on Lit Hub Which I think does, like, I think they do some of their own articles, but they also collate articles from other places. Now, this was the link that was in the newsletter. So the first part's a quote. For all the stories of literary wrongdoing, there aren't many stories of what led to this wrongdoing in the first place. Jumi Bello on why she plagiarized parts of her debut novel. So then I clicked that because it's a pretty, like, interesting kind of hook. But when I clicked on it, the article had been removed. And then I found a Guardian article. And so the essay was originally posted as an essay on why she had plagiarized parts of her book. But then the article was also partly plagiarized, and that's why it was removed.
Oh my goodness. I'm doing all these facial expressions to you because I found
this. Have you heard of this?
Well, I only found it yesterday on Twitter. And then I went in to the hole down the Twitter thread. It's so bizarre, but also if you look at it on Twitter, also there's some pretty funny takes on just the whole debacle. But yeah, it's wow.
Complicated at best, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's very complicated and there's some different takes on it. What's the one that got everyone going crazy last year? The bad art friend one. I feel like it's got potential to turn into that because it's, wow, complicated. Gosh, wow. I love a good literary scandal. They just get me every time, every time. I hope for our sakes that there's no literary scandals at Bendigo Writers Festival, but we'll be sure to talk about them.
I'd like some gossip, though. I remain perpetually hopeful.
I will have you on the phone for all the gossip as we progress. Don't get COVID or just get it quickly or just stay on the couch. Good luck, my friend.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.